Talk Shoes. Recorded live.
Good evening, listeners. I am Carolyn Yeager, and welcome to the Monday, October 31st installment of the Heretics Hour, being broadcast over Talk Shoe tonight because Voice of Reason Radio is not available right now due to a snowstorm power failure in Connecticut. All right, tonight's topic follows from last week's program on painting and sculpture in the Third Reich. With the help of William Fink of Christogenia.org, we have set up this Heretics Hour program page on TalkShoe, and we're able to do the program from here tonight. We don't have Wilhelm with us yet. I was talking with him just an hour ago, and he was going to be calling in at 6 o'clock his time, and yet he may be having some problems with it. So we will just start out here. You know, I've been looking up architecture and sculpture in the Third Reich all week, and I've got also information about the Autobahn and the Volkswagen. And it's all very exciting what was taking place in Germany by Germans in these two fields. And I'll just start out by saying that I have mentioned before that the general consensus is that painting did not reach the levels of architecture and sculpture during the Third Reich period, which we could say between 1933 and 1944, say. And I think that that is true. While there was a lot of good painting, and it was kind of it actually disappointed Adolf Hitler that he didn't find things art in the realm of painting that was more impressive than he did, but he was always still encouraging, and there were some very good painters. But you can't say that, of course, and we said that, I said that was not true of music either, because music was fabulous. But in the fields of architecture and sculpture, it was really reached a high level of achievement. Let me give a little background here with Adolf Hitler himself. Now, we know that he was a painter in his younger years, and that's what he thought he wanted to do as a career. But he was drawn more and more to architecture. He had always been drawn to architecture, buildings, and so on. And in fact, when he was a teenager with his friend Kubitschek, they would wander around, they walked around Linz, and he would discuss the buildings and tell his friend, how they should be done and what was wrong with them and how he would improve them. And he would, you know, he had all these ideas. And he was even doing architectural sketches then, I think. But he got more and more attracted to architecture, and he himself continued to do architectural design. And many of the buildings that were built during his time by well-known architects were based on sketches that he had done. And I wish we could show pictures during this radio broadcast because, it's just one beautiful image after another that we could be showing, and particularly, though, his sketches. I'm sure some of our listeners have seen them. He was very accomplished in doing exact architectural-type drawings of what his ideas were, and he had all kinds of ideas. And as we go on, I might just mention now because I might forget. For example, the opera houses that were designed during the Third Reich all ended up with this rounded front and then straight square ends on either side. Very attractive looking. And that came from him. And he first came up with that. And then he gave his ideas to the architects, and they were doing that, and that became kind of a style for the opera houses. So he was more involved in architecture than he was in what the painters were doing. He certainly wasn't doing any painting, at that later on. And, of course, he didn't do sculpture either. But sculpture was often used as a part of the architecture, as we know, not only the figures, like in the announcement that I sent out of the Reichs Chancellery with the two Arno Breckers, huge, these are much greater than life-size statues on either side of the entrance to the in the honor court. And this is a way of incorporating sculpture, the architecture. But also, a lot of sculpture was done that wasn't figurative freestanding statues, but that was relief sculpture on the on building fronts, or even eagles and decorations on buildings that are put on there in a form of a relief thing. And Arno Brecker actually did a lot of those. So that's where we stand with maybe why it blossomed so well. That's what I'm trying to say. Architecture may have blossomed so well because Adolf Hitler was not only supportive of it and very involved in it and wanted to do a lot of new building right from the start. And he was also an inspiration for it. And we're going to be able to show, I think, during this program that the interest that he had in redesigning Germany, not only the architectural and the whole city replanning ideas that he had for these, and where he did some redesigning of the entire central city so that it would be much more impressive and express the feelings of the German people better than the kind of a hodgepodge that cities become after a while. And all of these projects that he had, including the Autobahn Volkswagen, show that he never would have wanted war. And, of course, he didn't want war. He was trying to bring the German Reich back together without war, and he thought he could. He was being successful in it and thought he could continue to be with just one more deal with Poland, and then that's when they came down on him and in created World War II, and they created World War II, and he had to either give in to their demands, you know, give in and go along with the Allied Jewish Allied person, or he had to stand up to him. So he tried to stand up to him, but he certainly was not interested in going into a huge war and taking over the world. He really wanted to do this cultural work that he was had already begun and was so involved in Germany. You can't want to build and want to destroy at the same time. And he couldn't have been so dumb that he thought that he could go into a world war and he wouldn't suffer any devastation in Germany. The first building that he had constructed once he became the chancellor and then the Führer was this House of Deutsche Kunst, a huge new art museum. And I imagine he is probably the first leader of a major country ever whose first project was to build an art museum. Let's give some idea of what the architecture was and who the architects were. The most important early architect for the Third Reich was Paul Proust. And he renovated the Brown House in Munich, which was one of the early things that they did. They bought this building in Munich for the party. You know, National Socialist Party was serious right from the start in the early 20s because Hitler was serious. He took his ideas seriously, even though the rest of the country and world didn't. You know, said, well, he's nobody, and they're nothing. They're never going to get anywhere. But he did, and they managed to buy this building, and they call it the Brown House. Based on, you know, Braun in German, based on their brown uniforms, is what I understand. And Proust renovated that, and then Proust also is the designer of the House of German Art, the big, beautiful museum there, art museum there in Munich. The Führerbau, a Führer building, is still there, designed by him. And also there's the party administration building was designed by him. And it's still there, as far as I know, although you wouldn't recognize it from the way it was then. You know, the party, the yearly party rallies were very important, and so he put a lot of importance on having the right facilities. And the facilities that were designed there, and the original party congress hall was designed by Ludwig and Franz Ruff, R-U-F-F, done this beautiful Dutzendteich lake, and this was done in 35, but the Party Congress Hall was never finished. Later, Speer worked on it because he said that he had done all this, but it still wasn't finished. But that was because of the war. But Speer designed the Zeppelin Grandstand, which is still there, These are things people can still see, all of this, although they have these, this horrible exhibit in there telling you how awful the Third Reich was, and all these busloads of tourists come there just for that, you know, and they take them right in there to see the exhibit. All these places that are still standing, from what I could see when I was there, where they still have National Socialist buildings still there, they make sure more and more, they haven't always, but they're getting to where they're getting them everywhere, in all of them. They have these what they call documentation centers, and what they are is propaganda, you know, Jewish and allied propaganda telling you why this whole regime was so awful so that nobody will think well of it. But if you can ignore that, you can go. I didn't go into the Party Congress Hall because I didn't want to see what they had done in there. I just walked all around the outside and looked at it in the courtyard. But I did go to the Zeppelin grandstand. And, of course, in the pictures that we have from the time, it was just a magnificent place. And now it's kind of in a very bad way. I don't know if they'll even keep it there, but it's nice that it's still there enough that you can see it. And there are all kinds of other fields there and buildings, and it was just a magnificent large complex for the Nuremberg party rallies every year. You know, they try to say now that this was all a way, it's all just part of the whole dictatorial, overbearing, National Socialist Nazi stuff to take away people's free choice or something. Well, it was to inspire those who were party members who came once a year and give them some, you know, speeches and talks, and they had some demonstrations, and then people marched past the grandstand and so on, all these different groups, the workers' groups and the, you know, the Hitler Youth and so on. And too bad Wilhelm's not here. But he went one year with his Hitler Youth group, and he said he looked right into Hitler's eyes as they marched past, and they were very close to him. And, you know, they turned their head and look. But anyway, it was beautiful architecture, and Albert Speer, even though I'm sure he got some of his ideas from Hitler, you know, Hitler was always sketching out and handing them what he thought would be a good idea. He was a marvelous, inventive, creative builder, and he did a great job on everything that was his responsibility to do. You know, a Tempelhof was an advanced kind of design, and most of what was going on in Germany was very advanced, and the rest of the world was looking at it and saying, wow, look at that, and wow, look at that. And, you know, it wasn't until 38, 39 that all of a sudden the Third Reich was becoming some kind of evil empire. But the more that was in Berlin, there are a lot of embassies that were built during the Third Reich period. And let me just say that Werner March was another one of the very good architects. His last name is spelled M-A-R-C-H. And he designed the Yugoslav embassy in 1938 and 40 it was built. And it has it has ornamentation of these little faces above some of the windows and so on that were designed by Arno Brecker. And I believe they're still there. Then he also designed the Olympic Stadium in Berlin. This was a major construction operation, of course. And there's a plaque there with his bronze relief face on it saying that he was. And there you have a lot of sculpture, you know, in connection with the architecture. The Olympic Stadium is there today, and it's being used. It's kept up. It's beautiful. It's in use. But there, some of the famous sculpture that's there that you can see are the discus throwers and relay runners, Carl Adler. And there's Joseph Wackerle, man with horses sculptures. And he is also the one who did the Neptune fountain, which is still there in Munich. It's in the old botanical garden, and that's by Joseph Wackerle. It's also very impressive. Somehow it survived the bombing, even though everything around it was destroyed, amazingly. Let's see. It has the list of all the winners, and Jesse Owens is listed there and so on. Another thing in Berlin that you can see that's, I think you can see some of them. I don't know about all of them. The three flak towers, these are amazing. Well, we have pictures of them anyway, and they're also beautiful. These were towers that built for anti-aircraft gunners on the roof to shoot down the planes that were coming in to bomb the city. And inside the buildings, they had hospitals, they had air raid shelters, and they could serve food. They had all kinds of things for the people inside there and places for soldiers to stay in. But they were like 12 feet thick walls or something. They're all made of cement. And the designs, each design is different. And in Berlin, there were three. They had at the Tiergarten, which they call the zoo, which is near the zoo, and the Friedrichshain and Humboldtian. And then in Hamburg, there were two of them, and in Vienna, they built three of them. You know, once they started having these air raids, bombing raids, from the English and then the Americans, too. So this did a lot of damage to those planes. But the thing is, the towers themselves were really impressive architecture. And he designed these towers, too. He came up with these designs for this. And he handed it over to Speer, and he says, put it together like this and get these up. And Speer, who was very good at getting things done in a hurry, he was best. He was a genius at organization and went up like in a matter of months. Let me mention Hermann Giesler here. I haven't said anything about him, and I don't have anything too much to say except that some of the famous things that he designed were one of his first important jobs. Was the Sonthofen-Ordensburgen School, which was school for party members, and other to go to and learn all about National Socialism and become schooled in the thinking, you know, a deeper way. And it was beautiful. It had a beautiful tower. So there's pictures of it, but I think it's there, but it's in a place that I didn't go, so I didn't see it. But then in 38, he was made general building inspector for the reorganization of Munich. So before that, it was Fick. Roderick Fick was another important architect. He was in charge of redesigning Linz from early on. You know, Hitler put him in charge. And he lived down around there. I think he was in Bavaria or something. And he also designed the SS barracks and other buildings at Obersalzberg, which was, you know, near to Hitler's home. But at some point, Hitler was not as happy with what he was doing, and he put Giesler in charge of Linz. But first he put him in charge of Munich in 38, and that was a very, very big job. The reorganization of Munich meant the whole redesigning, and he worked with Hitler on that and so on. And then Hitler in 41 put him in charge of the Linz project. So he had a lot on his plate, plus he was doing all kinds of supervising all kinds of war construction, you know, in the Eastern Front zones. But he was a wonderful man, and most of these people were very devoted to Germany, and they didn't have any problem with the regime. Another one we haven't mentioned yet is Rudolf Walters, Walters, who worked for Speer, and he took over Speer's firm when Speer became armaments minister, which happened in 1941 when Fritz Todt, another important name, was killed. And he then took over major responsibility for the Berlin reconstruction. But by that time, there wasn't much they could do because everything had to go for the war effort. And that's what killed, you know, all the wonderful architectural developments that were going on, that were underway, was the war. You know, they just couldn't keep it all going. Another one was Julius Schulte Frohlinde, who... He constructed the DAF administration buildings, training schools, and helped plan the Kraft Durch Freude, or Work Through Joy. Wait a minute, I forgot what that means. The seaside resort called Prora, that's been in the news recently. That seaside resort, it's still there on the German island of Rügen. It's that building that has all these extensions coming out of a main line so that all the rooms have windows. And it's on Baltic Sea, is, or on the water, and it would be a resort for the working people. So he's the designer of that. Prora, listeners might, they can look it up. It was in the news recently. They turned it into something else, but German government has kept it, and pretty much the way it was, and it's been in use. It's some kind of a school or something now. But Speer invented the idea of ruin architecture, to where he recommended that the buildings that they really cared about be done with stone in the old way, like they built in Rome. When it fell into ruin, they would look like the Colosseum and buildings like that, and they would last forever, and even in a ruined state, there would be something solid about them. And that's how they thought at that time, because they were building for long term, they believed. We haven't talked about Dresden and Weimar, and I have a few notes about what can be found there in Dresden. There's some buildings that are still there, are headquarters of the Luftgau Kommando 4. These are military buildings. It was built in 35 to 38 for the Luftwaffe, and it's still in use today by the military. And there's a Luftkriegsschule, aerial warfare school, which featured a large, beautiful Brecker relief sculpture named with the name of Der Flieger. It was like the flyer. It was like a Greek myth-looking person flying with drapery and stuff. Beautiful, beautiful, very large on that building. I saw that, you know, you can see it in the pictures from then, but it's gone now. So the building is still there, but these are the things that they take away. And when we get to Brecker, I'll just say it now, so I don't forget it, that of his work that was public, like this Der Flieger on this building, 90% of it was destroyed. The only thing, most of what remains of Brecker were, you know, art pieces that were indoors or, you know, that weren't part of public buildings. And a whole lot of his work was a part of public buildings. So, but another building in Dresden is Bureau for Food and Nutrition Administration building. It's still there and in use. It had a large eagle with swastika decoration over the entryway. Also gorgeous, just beautifully designed, very large. It's gone, and it's been replaced by a small winged train wheel. well, then in Weimar, there was the famous Hotel Elephant, which is still there. That's a very interesting story. Yeah, I saw that and I went inside. But, you know, it's all changed. But the outside is the same, although there are pictures of Hitler there in 32 and 33 and probably 34. And then the facade was changed and kind of modernized and simplified by Hermann Giesler. And a small balcony was added over the entryway, and that was called the Hitler balcony because he would stay. He liked to stay in that hotel when he was in Weimar. And he would come out on that balcony and greet the people. So that has a lot of significance. And then they also had a Gau Forum there, which was never fully completed, but it's there, it says. It's a large complex, actually. It's a large complex for the Gaus. There was several buildings, and that was designed by Giesler. It was never completed because it was quite a few buildings, you know, several buildings all together in this complex. But some of them, the ones that were completed, are still there, used for some whatever. And there's a house of an office building that was housed the SS, SA, SJ, BDM, RAD, NS, KK, and NSV, all party things pretty much, that had a big building there in Weimar. And there was also something called the Christ House. I don't know what the Christ is cross, I think, but Christ House of the NSDAP, another party building, that is there, but without the eagle and swastika above the main entryway that used to be on it. So that's all I have for these particular buildings and architects. Yeah, and I've got also a picture here I came across. I just thought I'd mention it real quickly. It's a new museum in Berlin. It's called the New Music Museum. And it's on a body of water here, real close, and it just looks like something Soviet. And it has this odd, strange metal part to it that's sitting on top of the roof and jutting out. It has no grace, no beauty, no aesthetics, no nothing. It's just flat with these flat windows here and there. Maybe they're supposed to look like a keyboard or something. But no musical notes or something. But I mean, it looks. I've noted here that it looks weak. It looks impermanent. It looks like something that's built and not last very long, and we can just trash it later because it has no quality to it. And this is the kind of stuff that replaces what this horrible Adolf Hitler did. You know, if you go, particularly in what was East Germany, if you go around to those cities like Weimar and Dresden and so on, and you will find that any kind of statues that were up about National Socialism were removed, and they were what was put up was communist sculptures, and they're still there. They're still there, but you won't find anything in any National Socialist sculpture or public statuary, but you do find a lot of everything that the communists put up is still there. That's just the different attitude they take between those two regimes that are both supposed to have been equally bad, you know, both terrible. Wilhelm Christman, are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
Well, wonderful. All right, well, join in.
Well, you covered a lot of areas there. I just wanted to mention a few. I don't think you told the story about the three Ordensburg, the party academies, which were built early 38, I guess, even earlier. And one of the architects was Hermann Giesler. He built the one in southern Germany, Sonthofen. And the other one was in the Eifel Mountains near Vogelsang, and the third one in Pomerania, Krössensee, which is now in Polish territory, and I understand it's they use it as a very busy, visitor center. Then another thing is...
These are all still there? All three of these buildings are still
all
standing?
All three of them, specifically Sonthofen, was used and probably still used by the U.S. forces in Germany. It's down near Füssen in Allgäu, which is southern part of Bavaria, beautifully built and all in the typically granite and marble material, Vogelsang. Each of them, all three of them, are very harmoniously joining the landscape. I mean, Allgäu, it's already,
yeah.
You have the Alps there. In the Eifel, there are the dark forests. In Krössensee, in Pomerania, it's the lake district and flat, slightly hilly country. Well, like all the architecture in the Third Reich, harmoniously built in the landscape and really a beauty to look at and enjoy it. Also,
I wish we could show a picture of Sonthofen.
I think you mentioned a little bit the industrial architecture too, and military architecture. You know, when I joined the Luftwaffe in 1938, they transferred us to a new airfield in Lower Bavaria, Straubingen, the Donau. And that was a completely new airfield, partly still building, but the barracks, I still remember how we were surprised. Those were not empty wooden barracks, but one-story stone barracks with all the facilities, laboratories, showers. And we were four soldiers in a room, and there was in the center a big sporting arena, and that was only not only in Straubing, but a year later, I went up to the sea school at the Baltic Sea. The same thing. I mean, all the military buildings were architecturally beautiful. I think you mentioned the Luftkriegsschule, the academy in Dresden and in Gato, which were beautiful all around large area buildings with all the statues and green parking space, just tremendous here in the Indian.
Well, how would you explain, or can you explain why the Germans do everything with such, create so much beauty in what they design and in the way they organize things, when and other countries do not do as good a job with that so often? Like, take the United States. If you look at U.S. military installations,
I think architecture is symbolizing the character of a nation in a certain decade. I mean, and the amazing thing is that in the 12 years of the Third Reich, there's large projects were finished, not only on the military side or industrial side, but also in the art field. And that was the expression of beautiness, heroism, and idealism. And the decades before the Third Reich, the Weimar period, was symbolized by the Bauhaus, which was nothing else but the cathedral of Marxism.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the industrial, because as I understand it, Adolf Hitler had a different idea about architecture, industrial architecture, which he said could be in the modern style. It fit industrial, but it didn't fit government buildings or home, living buildings or anything like that, or art, museums and so on. He didn't want to see it there. But he said for industrial, the use of glass and steel and even some of this Bauhaus-looking, modern, plain-looking style was fine. And they did build some of it that way, didn't they?
Well, one of the leading architects of the Bauhaus was for a short while even on the Third Reich architecture involved, this Mies van der Rohe. He left them for the United States. But did you talk about the Volkswagen, since we were shortly mentioning the industrial architecture, about the Volkswagen Werk in Fallersleben, which is started and completed?
Go ahead, Wilhelm, and talk about that, the Volkswagen Werk.
Well, this is, I never saw it, I mean, but I saw the finished giant halls and beside the industrial section, they had also the living quarters for the workers. There were, at the time, I think, during the wartime, they had workers there up to about 12,000 people. And then all the aircraft factories in up in Rostock near Berlin, down in Friedrichshafen, all of them were modernized, some of them and most of them newly built.
Yes, and they were built along different ideas than the other buildings that we've been talking about, because they were utilitarian, right? Now, the Volkswagen, maybe we should take some time just to mention, I did do some research on that today, and I don't have time to talk about all of it, but I think people need to understand and realize that the Volkswagen was entirely designed by Adolf Hitler. It was his idea, and it's his design. Let me just say, it was in May 1937, it was turned over to Dr. Ley, who was the head of Arbeit, and Dr. Porsche, of the Porsche Automotive Works, and the Dr. Lafferenz, who was the head of the Kraft Deutsch Freude, which was strength through joy. This was, to find ways to do good things for the working class. And they made this car, was made of steel, powered by a 25-horsepower engine with enough room for four or five, and they did hard testing on it, and it proved it could easily maintain a speed of 100 kilometers per hour. So, and it only needed 7 liters of fuel for 100 kilometers, so that made it cheaper than public transportation. And so they knew they had a winner there, and it was all started by Hitler and his design. So he said it should be, well, he understood. He understood designing so well, he knew it had to not have any, air resistance. He designed it so it would have not too much air resistance, and put that motor in the back and all of that. And it needed no repair. It was so successful. And they created a modern city around the first plant factory for the Volkswagen. And it had a population of 30,000. It was supposed to rise eventually to 60,000. And it was for the workers and managers of the car factory. The recreational opportunities and pools and showers and cafeterias and all kinds of things were free. And it just goes on and on. But the fact was that they weren't able to produce enough of these cars for all the people that wanted one because it was under $1,000 for the, or no, 1,000 marks, under 1,000 marks for the car, which was quite.
Well, you know, I remember that you could put up a savings account for getting the Volkswagen already early in 38.
Yes.
And around all those industrial plants, and they had living quarters for the workers. And one family houses, most of them, in one of Giesler's book, he mentions the visit at the big steel factory in Linz, Austria, and then they went through the housing quarters of the workers there. And you know, all those workers, well, before the war broke out, they had their paid vacations on the big DAF boats all the way up to the fjords in Norway, to Tenerife and Madeira, and in the media center there. So there was a lot of activities for the workers here, paid vacations.
This is the direction things were going, and it was just wonderful. And then when Germany was forced to defend itself in war, it got worse and worse, and they couldn't keep up all this. And so people didn't get their cars after a while. And then there's the Autobahn, but let's maybe if we go on, we can talk about that later. Let's turn to the sculpture. Just going to list some of the best known sculptors during that time. The two favorites of Adolf Hitler were Joseph Thorak and Arnold Brecker. And they weren't just favorites of his because he had favorites, but they were the best. They were both, outstanding. Arnold Brecker was his most favorite, really. And we'll talk about his work and some others that who did beautiful work. Fritz Klimsch.
Oh, yeah, Klimsch and Kolbe. Fritz Kolbe, don't forget him, too.
Fritz who?
Fritz Kolbe, K-O-L-B-E. I think about, there were about elite, about 30, 40 sculptors. But the four outstanding were, as you mentioned, it's Brecker, Thorak, Kolbe, and Klimsch. And all of them, I mean, Brecker was a latecomer. I mean, he spent quite a few years with Rodin in France and came back to Germany in 1934. And from then on, he was the favorite of Hitler. And if you, there's an excellent book, which was published in 1992 by the Graber publishing house in Germany, and it's in English, French, and German, Ein Leben für das Schöne, Life for the Beautiful, and it's just amazing, the material of Brecker's work. I mean, I think he produced over between 200 and 300 portraits of busts of artists, politicians, and industrialists. And if you go through all those statues, I mean, the titles itself are very symbolizing about the idea what the whole art and would mean and what he wanted to tell the nation and the people of Russia. Well, you know, he made a lot of, in the beginning, when he came back in 1994, there were some people accusing him of the French fellow. But I think he was the sculptor symbolizing the idea of the new Germany. And, you know, I think he, remembering my Greek history when I was 14, 18, and when the Greek, the one word, kalos kagatos, the beautiful and the nice one, the good one, those were the ideals. And you see it, the revival of Greek idealism in all the sculptures in the Third Reich at that time. You know, remember Phidias and Praxiteles, the Pallas Athene in the old ancient Greek, and the Parthenon in Athens. Those were the symbols and the really the prototypes for the new art in the Third Reich. And too bad that we can't show all the photos and the statues of Brecker and Dorak and Kolbe and Klimschitz. Still there, some of them are still around, but a lot of them have been destroyed during the Allied air raids and shortly after the war, militias.
Did they just blow some of them up? I saw a picture of two, I think they were the two sculptures, they look like the two sculptures that were, that I have in the picture for the show, of the party and the Wehrmacht. But they might have been others. But they were in a, like somebody's backyard with laundry hanging there, and they were laying down on the ground, broken up.
Yeah, well, you know, at the Olympic Stadium today still, there are some statues of, I think, Kolbe and Brecker.
No, it's not Brecker at the Olympic Stadium. I thought they were Brecker when I was there. But at the Olympic Stadium, it's, let me get that here.
Well, I think it's Mach who built the stadium.
But he designed it, but the sculptures, that's
just
a
somebody. Yeah, it might be Klimsch. Well, you know, at the time when I was in Berlin, I picked up the staff officers at the Olympic Stadium, and there were the monuments there and the big two towers, called the Marathon Gates. Very, very, very. Where did you find who designed the statues at the Olympics? No.
Well, I will, but Thorak had some works at the Marsfeld in Nuremberg, at the Marsfeld of the rally grounds. He did this gigantic Goddess of Victory, which I think exists, but not in the grouping that it was meant for, because it wasn't all completed. But, maybe they just had the models of it, but he was working on it, this picture in his studio. You know, Thorak had a gigantic studio, pictures inside of it. You see, he's got...
Well, you're both of them, Thorak and Brecker.
Yeah, Brecker. But Thorak worked even much larger than Brecker ever did.
Yep.
And he's got, there's big ladders and cranes in there, you know, and you see the person... with a horse down below, because he did a lot of horses, and so he had a horse there as a model.
Yeah.
And just tiny, like little toy soldiers or something, you know, to a...
Well, Dorak had his big studio outside Munich. You know, he was born in Salzburg, and I think he built the one giant monument for the Autobahn from Munich to Salzburg. I don't know if what it was ever put on the Autobahn or just stayed in his atelier. And Brecker had a giant studio outside Berlin. And I think still today there's a Brecker Museum, I think somewhere in the Rhineland, maybe outside
Yes, there is. There is. And I have some information about it. This Brekker Museum was built, but here, I don't know if this is at the Brekker Museum, but in 2006 at the Schleswig-Holstein House in Schwerin, the capital of the state of Mecklenburg, West Pomerania, they decided to exhibit 70 works owned by Brekker's widow. And they did so, and there was a lot of controversy about it, of course. People from the left said it was a big mistake, and you know, but the person who wrote this up said that Brekker was a genius and should not be judged by political standards. You know, his art should not be judged by political standards of the day, which of course it shouldn't be. You know, the fact is that 90% of his pre-1945 work was public work, it was destroyed.
Well, I think a lot of his portrait busts must be still around and owned by private people, because there were all in all, if I remember correctly, close to 300 portraits.
Well, I'm looking for this. I just found the information that we were looking for, Wilhelm, and the sculptures that are at the Olympic Stadium in Berlin, that are there now. The two where there's two men together, two athletes standing together. One is discus throwers, and the other is relay runners. They're by Carl Abacher. I never had heard of him, and they don't say who they're by on them. You know, so when I was there, I thought they were by Brekker or something. But they're by Carl Abacher, and then they have those wonderful man with horse sculptures. I think there's more than one, one that you always see the picture of, but there's more than one there. And those are by Joseph Wackerle.
I remember now, it just came to my mind, at the Olympic Stadium, I visited Dietrich Eckart Bühne. You were in Nuremberg, Caroline, weren't you?
Yes.
In September 1938, we were camping there in a big camp town, or really city, and in it. But there must have been between 30,000 and 40,000 youngsters from all over Germany. Yeah, we were, from my home province, from Kärnten, we were about 300, somewhere between 300 and 400, and that was a privilege. Many more than all the other districts in the Reich, and we were all jointly camping in a big tent area. I think it was called Langwasser, and then we marched. My goodness, I remember then the march, and then all the at night the big dome of the searchlights. You know, that was. I think it was either the idea of Speer or of Leni Riefenstahl. And the exercise.
I think it was Speer. I've always read it was Speer's idea. Incredible, too.
But, you know, Leni Riefenstahl was very important in with her influence of the of documentary. I mean, she was pioneering something unusual, which is still today acknowledged by documentary experts. The whole film, the movies about the Parteitage, but also the movies about the Olympic Games, extremely successful.
That was all a great triumph, and it was done the German way, not the Nazi way. It was done a German way because Germans are good at that, and they did a wonderful job of hosting that Olympics. Everything they did was just right, and everything they created and built for it was beautiful.
You know, completely new.
I'm not saying others don't do a beautiful job
completely.
Also, but, you know, that was a beautiful Olympics. Let's kind of get back to the sculptors. I wanted to mention that this Fritz Klimsch, who there is a sculpture of his that is still existing that can be seen. It's a public sculpture. It's the Looker, Die Schauende, Wilhelm. It's a nude female that's looking out at Lake Chiemsee, or Lake Chiem, the Chiemsee, which means the Chiem Lake. Autobahn rest stop, and that's still there, I think. It's the Autobahn rest stop in southern Bavaria. That was one of the first, that was the first rest stop highway road stop, I think, that was maybe ever existed. But this was they built this rest stop there, and it was quite elaborate. It wasn't just an ordinary rest stop. I mean, it had lodging, but it had a big restaurant. You could swim in the lake there. It had an area where you could swim. It had all kinds of nice things, and of course you'd gas up. And there was this female nude sculpture that must be fairly large, but they've got it out there on the water, kind of on a ledge looking out, and it's turning and looking back. It's a beautiful sculpture. It's lifelike, but it's a little bit slightly expressionistic because the waist of this female is very small. It looks almost, it could be, but it isn't quite as Greek-looking as some of them. So it's very nice, and then this, as I said, there's the Neptune Fountain in Munich, Wackerle, which I don't know if I saw that or not because I didn't know about it, and if it's somewhere off the beaten road, I guess I missed it, darn it.
There's another feature of architecture which you'd mention, and those are the bridges on the Autobahn and at the rivers. Remember?
Yes.
One was the Mangfall Bridge here near in southern Bavaria. And then across the Danube, the Nibelungen Bridge, which was really finished, part of the renewal of Linz, which Giesler was supposed to take care. Well, he did. All the plans were finished and the models were finished. But there was some work done along the banks of the Danube and some widening of the small streets leading from the Danube to the railway station.
And also Fritz Todt, who was in charge of the Autobahn, he got together with Alwin Seifert. He engaged the landscape architect Alwin Seifert, especially for the Munich to Salzburg portion, which was the most beautiful because it had the most fantastic.
Yeah, it's quite a thing.
And where they wanted to direct traffic to Lake Chiem.
It's the Rathaus on the Chiemsee. That's what he did.
Yes, and so this was where they did so much of that really exciting work and bridges and so on, so that they could take the traveler through the most beautiful areas. And it seemed to be nothing was in their way. I mean, they had some fantastic ones, you know, in the book by that.
I think a very important part of architecture is the interior, the furniture, the carpets, the use of different marbles, primarily Carrara and Travestin from Italy, and then the famous Untersberg marble from Salzburg with this slightly reddish color and the beige kind veins in there. Very, very important interior architecture in the Südreich.
Well, this brings up that they're always saying that the Nazis had no taste. They were like barbarians. And they had, and you know, this is so easily disproved. And it isn't the case at all. I mean, everything that was being done there, and it was being done by Nazis, it was in the best of taste. The bridge designer was Paul Bonatz. Does that ring a bell, Wilhelm? Bonatz. And I've got some pictures of some of the bridges here. There's one over the Lahn River at Limburg, and over the Stuttgart-Ulm Autobahn. There's some magnificent looking picture. Here's one at the Rhineland, a stone bridge near Rhineland Palatinate.
Well, like the first one.
These aren't even in the south, in the southern part.
Right, and the first big bridge was the Mangfall Bridge in Upper Bavaria, and crossing a deep gorge and the Autobahn there. You know, just the first Autobahn leg from Munich towards the Austrian border, but they're just beautiful, harmoniously lined through the whole landscape. And it was just not a cement line, but in between the green grass areas. That was a new one too. And then the two or three resting inns, which were already built at that time. And later on, I mean, then the lake along the Rhine Valley, and then the one from Frankfurt to Darmstadt, and the one from eastwards all the way up to Rostock, just unbelievably built into the landscape and not disturbing at all the people.
A few facts about the Autobahn, because they like to say, the ones who want to tear down the Third Reich, they like to say that, oh, that Autobahn was started long before Hitler, and it wasn't his idea, and he just took advantage of other people's ideas and then, you know, got credit for it. Well, you know, there was discussion about highways, not only in Germany, but in Italy and France and other places, but nothing too much had been done, and there was an Autobahn segment that was built between Cologne and Bonn in between 1929 and 1932. And it took 3 years to build this segment between Cologne and Bonn. Then in 1933, Hitler took over, and he made some changes. And he moved to centralize highway planning and road construction. And he changed it from the Hamburg-Frankfurt-Basel to something larger, a whole network in Germany, and it was called basically Reichsautobahnen. And anyway, he inaugurated, and they made their first cut of the spade in Frankfurt in September 1933, mm-hmm. and in between 1933 and 1938, they added 3,000 kilometers of Autobahn network. So the other took 3 years to do just a short distance, whereas in this 5-year period, is it, they did 3,000. And then what got in the way after was, you know, it was once again the war. And all that needed to be done for the war, so they weren't able to make too much progress. They only added about 800 kilometers after that. Hmm?
Dot was the father of the Autobahn. His idea was then, well, later on, unfortunately, he was killed very early in an airplane crash. But the organization.
Well, now listen to this, Wilhelm. I have to say this, because another thing, I was looking at a site today. Well, it was about.com. They had a timeline on the Autobahn. That's where I got some of this information. But they want, of course, put down Hitler all the time. And here's what they say on here. This is an example of internet perfidy. They say 1942, Fritz Todt is killed in a plane crash in East Prussia on 8th February. There is speculation that Hitler had a hand in his death. History architect Albert Speer. Can you imagine sticking that sentence in there with no source, no nothing? I've never even heard that before. Speculation that Hitler had a hand in the death of Fritz Todt. He was very upset. Wilhelm, what more do you have to share with us about the sculptors or the?
Well, you mean what I think about Speer? I couldn't get you.
Well, we kind of talked about that, but yeah, tell us what you think about Speer. That would be very interesting.
Well, you know, I have both his books, his Spandau Remembering, and then he was a very highly intelligent man, but he was an opportunist too. And I think accusing himself during the Nuremberg trial as one of the instigators of crime saved probably his life, but it didn't save him of the 20 years he has to spend at the Spandau jail. And after he was released, after the 20 years, in his interviews and books, I mean, he devastating statements and denying all his heroic actions and dedications during the 12 years in the Third Reich. I think it's characterless, I think.
Yeah, and there are some. Do you think he convinced himself that that was true, or You have an opinion on that? We don't. Nobody knows, but he's just able to do that. He's just able to turn like that without caring, or he got.
You know, one
of the Allied thinking that he was disgusted with himself or something, or what in the world? Besides
one,
saving his life, I guess, but then he continued with it afterwards.
I think
he wants to get along with all the people in the world today.
Well, I think it's very indicative. There's one of his best friends. I think, Caroline, you mentioned his name, Walters.
Yeah, Walters.
Yeah, after the war, when he found out what happened at Nuremberg and his interview with the Playboys and the books, he was just criticizing so badly Speer, giving up his friendship and accusing him of kind of being a traitor of his own life.
That was a difficult thing for him, and that was all a big scandal, kind of. Speer did this so many wonderful things for the Third Reich, but almost everything that he did, it was Hitler. Maybe I'm wrong. See, tell me what you think of this. It was I don't want to take away from his great ability, but it was Hitler who came up with the basic idea and said, let's do it like this, and then Speer would go ahead and do it like that and do, maybe add some of his own, and do a fantastic job. But I don't know what Speer's own ideas would have been. What is there that is designed by him that you would say, what he did maybe pre-Hitler or what he did altogether on his own? Nobody knows.
Just in Hermann Giesler's book, The Art of Hitler, there's quite a long chapter when Giesler reports all his doing during the war, before the war, which Speer as a kind of a competitor, and how Speer tried to outdo him at Hitler
there's a lot that can be said against the man as a human being. Well, that's too bad, but Hitler really liked him, and they had a very good relationship. And so he was maybe kind of like a chameleon. He could be what he needed to be, and he seemed to be. He worked very hard as the armaments minister, and he did a very good job, as you've told me. So it's not that he couldn't do a good job and that he didn't do a good job for the Third Reich, but then when the Third Reich was out of power and he just got along with those who were in power. Well, we're going to bring this program to a close, and I want to thank you so very much for your contribution tonight, and I'm so glad you finally got on, Wilhelm.
Well, I'm sorry that I came a little bit late in there, but I was listening in, and I think it was a very good discussion on the day. Good night,
though. And so this is the end of our Sculpture and Architecture in the Third Reich. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. Do come back next week. Good night.